And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I have recently had a lot of questions coming in regarding how to handle this bear market, whether it has to do with putting money in the market or taking money out or doing something to stop the bleeding by selling some of the equity holdings. All of those topics are on the minds of some percentage of the people who follow our work. And I thought it would be a good time, as a matter of fact, a good enough time that Rich Buck and I are working on an article for Market Watch in the coming week or weeks, having to do with one of these topics. But I thought it would be a good time to revisit a podcast and an article that we did many years ago that I made the case, and I think the title went something like this: Successful Investing is 99.9% Defense. And that information kind of leads into the topic that I want to talk about today, because today I want to focus on what I think is the toughest decision that investors have to make. And it's a decision that, in a sense, they potentially wake up every morning and might have a thought, should I or shouldn't I? But before we get to that big challenge, I want to go back over what I talked about years ago, because I really do believe that successful investing is mostly about, in fact, almost all about defense. I think most investors think of investing, particularly those who don't understand the process, as being very aggressive. It's all about offense. It's about picking the right stock. It's about picking the right time. It's a lot of things that can literally be scary to people. But the reality is, to do it right, to be the best lifetime investor you can be, here is how I've concluded that it's almost all about defense. Now, what I mean by that is, anything that is a risk out there, it could be an emotional risk, it could be a financial risk, it could be an opportunity lost, an opportunity risk, because you did one thing versus another. There are lots of ways to look at the defensive nature of investing. But give me just a few minutes to quickly go over how I see those defensive steps. And a lot of this will sound like the 12 simple ways to supercharge your retirement. Big surprise there, right? But be patient. Let's go through these decisions that you're going to make. Certainly, save versus spend. I mean, obviously, if we don't save, we're going to end up years from now living off the government or our neighbors or our kids or something. So certainly saving itself is a defensive step against failure. And of course, saving early. When you start 5 years earlier than the normal person might start, not only do you get five more years of compound returns, likely, by the way, doubling what you'll have at the end of your work life, doubling because of those 5 years. And that it is during those 5 years that you could have one of two things happen. One is, it could be a phenomenal 5 years, in which case you were there, you took advantage of it, and you, when you started that sixth year, think how far ahead you were of other people just getting started. Not only did they not put any money away, they missed the big market move. And the other side of that coin is, it's a terrible 5 years, in which case it isn't going to feel all that exciting except, one, you will have saved, and two, you will have picked up a lot of equities at discounted prices, which in the long run should serve you well. And oh, by the way, the people that don't take these defensive steps, who let the market tell them what to do rather than doing what is in their own best interest, at the end of that 5 years that the market is particularly bad, it may be very difficult for them to invest. In fact, the 70 through 74 period was a disaster for investors, and yet from 75 to 82, one of the biggest bull markets of all time. So, save versus spend, save early versus later, definitely defensive steps in mind. Number three is the decision to have your money in stocks versus bonds. Now, we know bonds are more risky on a short-term basis, but we also know there's tons of evidence that over a long period of time, one of the best defenses you have against inflation, which is, in a sense, a guaranteed loss coming your way over your lifetime, if you don't do something about it, but that stocks are the right thing to do to defend against the impact of inflation. And of course, go back to what I said just a minute ago, yes, on a short-term basis, it's not a defensive step. It is there strictly for the long-term. And then we come to decision number four, and that is many stocks versus one or two or three. And we have learned about the impact of diversification, how the expected rate of return of 500 stocks is likely actually a higher rate of return than 5 or 10 stocks. It's kind of counterintuitive, but there is for people who buy individual stocks, there's a temptation to chase recent performance, which tends not to work out that well often. And then number five, another defensive step, is to own not just many stocks, but many different equity asset classes. Whether it is just the S&P 500 plus small cap value, or the S&P 500 plus large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value, or whether it's some combination of those and international equity asset classes, the fact is, when you have all of your money in any single asset class, you run the risk over extended periods of time to, I'll call it gross underperformance. And of course, we've talked about that a lot over the years. And then number six is either you select the equities to put in your portfolio, or you have professionals do it. That would be a mutual fund. And of course, my sense is that the mutual funds are going to do better over the long term than the individual. By the way, individuals typically are overly optimistic. They're overconfident. So when I say they're not likely to be able to do any better than the mutual funds, and they're going to take more risk in the process, more than likely, they can't accept that because they have confidence in their own abilities. And I think that's great. I wish them luck. Number seven, do you put your money into a load mutual fund or a no-load mutual fund? Well, you know, what's the risk of a load fund? Immediately, 5% or more of your investment goes into somebody else's pocket. And some people will say, well, they're being paid for what they recommended, and it's just short term that you've got the problem. But the fact is that payment of 5% is 5% that stops working for you and your family forever. It is just as harmful as if you paid one half of 1% more than you needed to in expenses, because that is another area, and that would be number 8, is the selection of lower expenses. Puts more money in your pocket. And so that is an important step, and one that I hope you've gotten that message. And number 9 is the decision to choose between index or passively managed funds and actively managed funds. And there again, they're coming at you from a whole bunch of different directions with extra expenses. The extra expenses could be the cost of buying and selling, because the active manager does more of that than the index fund. It could be because the actively managed funds has much higher expenses. And it could be because the taxation on active management, believe it or not, in a taxable account is about a 1% a year cost more in an average actively managed fund than an index fund. So they're coming at you in terms of expenses a number of different ways. And of course, I'm always trying to figure out, how do you keep that money in your pocket? Now, number 10 is also a tax consideration, and that is whether to put your money in a tax-deferred or a tax-free investment. I am, when you qualify for it, I am a huge fan of the Roth IRA or the Roth 401k. But a regular tax-deferred 401k or a tax-deferred IRA are fine as well. But I'm just wanting to defend against the possibility of very high tax rates later in your life. And then number 11 is the decision to dollar cost average into the market, as opposed to trying to figure out when to get in. The market is down. I think it's going to go down lower, you might say, and therefore I don't want to buy right now. I want to wait, because if I wait, I'll be able to buy more shares at a cheaper price. It is my experience that people are way better off just dollar cost averaging into the market, which really takes a lot of that emotional hurdle away, because it tells you exactly how your money should be invested every month. And number 12, buy and hold versus market timing. And of course, the idea is that market timing is going to defend you against market declines. And a market timer could have you in when the market's going up and out when the market's going down. It is one wonderful sales pitch. The problem is most people get it absolutely backwards. And so it is my belief that if you believe in buy and hold and you stick with it, you are going to do a lot better than with market timing. Now, in a sense, you take more risk, because with market timing, you're out of the market part of the time. But I just don't find do-it-yourself market timers, in fact, even professionals struggle with this, maintaining those mechanical market timing systems that are so easy to present, but so very difficult for people to do. And finally, number 13 is the decision: you do all of this yourself, or you hire an advisor to do it. Now, obviously, in fact, I just saw an article that I'll talk about in another podcast put out by people who make money referring you to managers. So they really want you to hire a manager. I also know that if you learn about how the investment process works, and if you do the low expenses and the broad diversification and the diversification of equity asset classes and all of these things, which one by one really are pretty simple, that you can do this yourself. because the lifetime return on the taking the time to get the education to do this and to maintain this, that difference is absolutely huge over paying somebody 1%. Now, it may be that all you have to do in order to get a return that is just as good as you would get from hiring a professional advisor is just to put your money in a target date fund. And those things cost less than 0.1% a year for the work that is done. So, one of my favorite breakfasts in the world is breakfast with George Sisti. I don't think there's anybody else that I have any more fun with at breakfast than George Sisti. He's one of our truth tellers. He is somebody, I love his perspectives on the market. And when we were recently together, we spent some time talking about this defensive aspect of investing. And as we talked about it, we concluded that of all the things that we are asked to do as an investor, that more than likely the most difficult thing is to be a buy and holder and stay a buy and holder. Now, those of you who are absolutely committed to buy and hold, it's almost like if somebody offered you a cigarette and you said, no, I don't smoke. Somebody suggested you should get out of the market and protect yourself from the upcoming bear market. You say, no, I don't market time. I stay the course on a buy and hold basis. But there are a lot of people that is a real fight. Now, I consider it personally, this decision to be in or out of the market, almost like the feelings that I have with a diet. I've been on a diet literally since the fifth grade. I've talked about this over the last decades and confessed that I have lost thousands of pounds and yet I am still 30 pounds overweight. Now, there are so many books and the strategies and diets and all of that that I could go on to become svelte and the trim young man I once was in the fifth grade. But the fact is you are constantly being tempted by food, good food, food that just tastes. In fact, if you've had a sad day, that food will make you feel so good. And if you've had a good day, that food is great to celebrate with. Now, those of you who don't have a weight problem, you're saying, what's your problem, Paul? It's all very simple. And you are right. But it isn't simple for those, for example, who get uncomfortable with our life savings losing 10 or 20 or 30% of its value, and we sit there and we don't do anything about it. And even if we are kind of forced to be a buy and holder, we're always questioning, God, should I get out now? I can get back in later when it's lower. So here's what George and I talked about. We talked about all of the different decisions that we make as a good investor. And a lot of them are right in that list, of the 99.9% is about defense. They're right there. Diversification of many equity asset classes. The diversification with fixed income. Again, to address loss when the market goes down. To be able to pick and invest in mutual funds. I think it's pretty simple. I don't think there is a great hurdle. Now, I will tell you the hurdle I see often in the selection of mutual funds or ETFs. People want to buy a fund that's been doing well lately. If we say you should be in a small cap value fund, they're going to look to see what's the best performing small cap value for the last year or two or three and think that's the right answer for the future. And for a lot of reasons, that it probably isn't the right answer. But generally speaking, my sense is it's not a huge hurdle to decide you're going to diversify amongst different equity asset classes, that you're going to keep your expenses low, that you're going to focus on being tax efficient, that you're going to pick passively managed funds over actively managed funds. You're going to look for all the ways to diversify. You're going to use your dollar cost averaging strategy. And you know to pick the what I call University Street versus, or the academic community versus Wall Street, or versus your next door neighbor. You know that that's a better decision. And I think trusting University Street is really, truly one of the easiest decisions to make because, I mean, they don't know the future. They do not know the future, but there's nobody who knows the past better than the academics. And I won't have any trouble 10, 20 years from now, if I could be around here to give you help, that I would ask, are you still in low expense funds? And you say, yes, sir, I'm still doing it. It's easy. But the one decision that is not easy is this idea of sitting there and watching your life savings. Remember, in a average bear market, and you get this kind of a bear market every 4 to 5 years, you lose over 30% of the equity value of the portfolio. Well, you know, when you look at the long term and you expect to get a 10% compound rate of return or 12% maybe in small cap value, then you think during the planning stages that, yes, I'm willing to go through all of that. The ups and downs of the market, yeah, sure, that's normal. Yeah, I'll buy that. But that attitude changes so often. There's one young fellow that's been sending me emails recently, and he wants to believe so, but he just can't get it. How can we overlook the problems of inflation? How can we overlook the problems of higher interest rates? How can we overlook the fact that the market's overvalued and it's going to crash? Well, this, of course, is the challenge of buy and hold. None of that matters in terms of what you do with your portfolio. I would say it's very, very important if you were a buy and holder and you're sensitive to losing money that you have the right amount of fixed income in your portfolio. But we've taken care of that for you. By the way, we haven't taken care of it. We have simply found the data and showed you with different combinations of equities and different equity combinations of how they perform and how much risk you would have taken, and whether it's a bad year, a bad 3 years, a bad 5 years, with 10% equity, 20% equity, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. So you can see, you can plan, you can say, I am willing to accept this much loss. And that's kind of the best that we can do. But I will tell you, I don't know of any other decision that investors have to make that is any more difficult than this decision. Do I stay the course or do I go someplace where it feels safe? And here's the challenge. Just like we don't know what the market's going to do in the future on the upside, we also don't know what the market's going to do on the downside. Now, we have shared with you that great work that Daryl Balls has done in putting together the quilt chart that goes all the way back to 1928. And bear markets tend to be pretty volatile. And boy, were the bear markets of 1929 through 38, were they volatile, very volatile. At the end of that 10-year period, the return was about the same as the S&P 500 from 2000 through 2009. In fact, you were a little better off from 29 to 38, but you went through a very volatile time with many bear markets. The difference is that in that 29 to 38, there were small and big bear markets. But in the case of 2000 through 2009, there were two times the S&P 500 was down over 50% from a peak. So, but I should mention, there was a time that the S&P 500 back in that 29 to 38 period, that the S&P 500 was down 83%, and small cap blend and value were down even more. So the question is, if this is the most difficult hurdle for investors, what should we make sure that we are doing to prepare ourselves for however bad a bear market is going to be? Now, for young people, I just cannot make this point strong enough. If you are in a diversified portfolio, whether it's small cap value or the S&P 500 or some other of the 10 equity asset classes that we believe will serve you well for the long term, there is nothing wrong with having the opportunity to buy more of those shares at lower prices. It is in the long run in your best interest. So celebrate. Be happy. Not for a 78-year-old guy like me who doesn't like the market going down a lot, but be happy for the people like yourself who have a chance to load up on really great asset classes at lower prices. On the other hand, there are the people who are sitting on a bunch of cash. They want to invest. They just inherited it, or it's the proceeds from their second house that they've gotten out of, and they're not going to own another second house. They want to put that money to work. How to do that? Well, I will tell you, there's probably almost nothing more frightening to investors than to think they're about to put $1 million into the market and could wake up a couple months from now with $700,000 worth of investments. So while it is not a perfect way to do it, I do believe, now when I say not a perfect way, all of the studies will say, if you got money, put it in there. Don't worry about the fact the market won't go down, because usually you come out ahead, even if you buy in at the top. Well, I would rather do something more cautious. I'm not sure that doing it exactly right is going to mean you're going to have enough more money that it's going to change your lifestyle. I would just like it to be done in a way that you have a sense of security while you're going through the process, which means typically that you do some sort of a dollar cost average in over a period of time. It could be for a year. Or you could put half of it in and the other half you could dollar cost average in over 2 years. And I've said this 100 times, don't forget that after you've completed the dollar cost averaging process, whether it's for 40 years or for 2 years, the next thing that could happen is the market could go down 50%. And you might say, well, all that dollar cost averaging wasn't good in the end. Well, this is why when we get older and the size of our portfolio grows and protecting that money becomes more important, we start adding fixed income. But a lot of people say, I don't want fixed income. I mean, whoever made a lot of money in fixed income? Well, that isn't the point. It's who kept themselves from losing a lot of money because they had a balance of fixed income and equity. So, those adding the fixed income, doing it if you're young, just stay the course. And then for a lot of us, and boy, am I embarrassed, for a lot of us, it's having somebody else do it. And that's expensive, and I know it's expensive. It's like hiring people to work for you when you're building a business. I was lucky to have a son who took care of the administrative end of our business as it was growing. And I've always been really frugal, so my temptation was to understaff. And what he believed in was building ahead of the growth rather than playing catch-up. And not only are there challenges for the clients, but there's challenges for the people who work there when you're playing catch-up. All you have to do is talk to people that are working at Vanguard right now. I haven't talked to anybody at Vanguard that's all that excited about working there lately. It's been tough because they got just buried and got behind. By the way, they're working hard to try to get unburied. They're just as committed as ever, but they've got to fix their systems to be able to do what they used to do before everybody wanted to put their money there. So for some people, it is to get an investment advisor who will do it for you. And for those who are frugal, don't want to pay an investment advisor, but want the help of an investment advisor, there are good investment advisors who tell you what to do. But then you have to do it. They know the what to do. It's not that they know the future. Nobody knows the future. But they know, at least looking to the past, what you should be doing based on all the things that you will tell them. But if you're willing to do what they tell you to do, you can manage a $10 million account for probably no more than $1,000 worth of the time of the advisor to tell you what you should be doing. Now, it might take another $1,000 to get the tax advice, professional tax advice you need. But for many people, the answer is, unfortunately, or fortunately, because I must say that I feel free to not worry about the day-to-day market at all, because I know somebody's taking care of all that. I don't mean that somebody is there making the market go up. Nobody can do that. And this is not the last time I'm going to talk about this subject. I think it's an important one. So here's what I'd like from you. I'm assuming that many of you are dedicated buy and hold investors, but you weren't always. You had to get there somehow. I would love to hear how you got there and how you maintain and keep the bear market talk and the falling value of your portfolio from motivating you to do something that is not in your best interest. And again, when I say that, please understand, I have no idea where the market's going to go from today until the day I die. And so nobody can tell you that. But boy, if you know what your limits are on the downside, please figure out from our fine-tuning tables what the combination is of equity and fixed income. And if you're relatively young and you don't like losing any more than 25%, which would suggest that you should be maybe 50-50 or 60-40, 60 equity, 40 fixed income, fine. Maybe that means you work a couple years longer. Maybe that means you save a little more. But you do it with peace of mind. And that peace of mind is so important in keeping you on course. So 99.9% of successful investing is defensive. And almost all of those defensive steps are steps that you can take without having to know the future returns of your investments. And then you need to figure out how to make sure that you are protected from those human emotions that we don't want to lose money. So, as always, I wish you well. I am so happy. I've been reviewing the work that we've done over the last 10 years. I got to tell you, I am feeling very, very encouraged, not only by what was accomplished over the last 10 years, but what's coming in the next 10 years. And I hope you will be around, stick around, and let's do it together. And let's share this information with others that we think will be helped. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.